This is a recording from the Jefferson Literary and Debating Society at the University of Virginia, made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. For more from the Society and for other lectures and radio shows, visit sevillepodcast.com. Nancy Forbes and George O. Strawn addressed the Jefferson Society on Friday, September 19, 2008, on the topic of the development and dangers of technology in society. Nancy Forbes is the author of Imitation of Life, How Biology is Inspiring Computing. George Strawn is the Chief Technology Officer at the National Science Foundation.
First, I'd like to thank Bailey Barfield and the Jefferson Literary Debating Society for inviting us here to talk to you about the future of computing. Before I take up this topic, however, a little deviation, I want you to know what a thrill it is for me to speak before this body. I was a member of the first class of women here in 1974, and I still maintain strong ties to the university. With roughly 300 first-year women and 8,000 undergraduate males, it was a memorable and uneasy time for the university. Professors were uncertain about how to treat us. Classmates were uncertain about how to treat us, and we had very little or no guidance to help orient us to the university. Being told that, true to Jefferson's exhortation, we were free to find our own way. It's a little, you know, ambiguous. When asked about how he chose the original 300 women, the then dean of admissions, Ernie Earn, replied, "I looked for survivors." For me, finding my own way meant an original major in the humanities, and then a return to school 6 years later to study physics at Columbia. Writing in science and technology has been a very satisfying way for me to combine the two disciplines, and my work in D.C. has really always been at the interface of science, technology, and government. I currently work for a small high-tech company where I advise the military on emerging technologies. So now let's get on to the subject at hand. As you're well aware, computers are everywhere these days. They're in cars, they're in washing machines, they're in homes, they're in libraries, they're in high finance, they're in government. They're so ubiquitous, we hardly even notice them anymore. Though their capabilities can sometimes blow us away, the fact is they can be very unreliable. Computers are machines, right? If a part fails, if a wire is cut, if the power surges, if they fall to the ground, they break. The more complex the programs they run, and the broader their span of control, sometimes operating many, many interconnected systems like the space shuttle, the more worrisome this fact is. What if the breakdown occurs during some critical operation like a medical surgery? When we compare these machines to biological organisms, we see that the latter grow, they adapt, they evolve, they learn from their surroundings, they self-diagnose themselves when they are injured, and they self-heal. Unlike computers and similar kinds of machines, which are brittle, natural organisms are malleable, they're redundant, and they're resilient. Like computers, natural organisms also process information, as you're well aware. From the smallest organism, which senses an evolutionary algorithm to add to and to, or to send an email. But what you would do is, if you're looking for a solution to a problem, you would guess at it. And maybe you would make two very rough guesses. And then you would take parts, and you would look at them as if they're their parents. These typical solutions. You would take parts of those solutions, you would sort of mate them, and you would find, you know, you'd find their daughter solution to that, and you would run this, you know, many, many, many thousands of times. You would, you know, one generation followed by another generation, each generation being fitter and fitter and fitter and fitter. Such that after many, many runs of this computer algorithm, you would find something that's, you know, pretty well approximates an optimum solution. So these are algorithms that are used a lot in high-tech solutions. For example, if you have a very big factory and you have a lot of operators, you have a lot of complex machines, different processes and you have a very strict timetable and you want to get the maximum output right from your factory floor, you would use an evolutionary algorithm to put all these different factors in there and say, okay, what's the optimum combination of operators and processes and intervals of time and so on that I can run this whole operation such that I get the maximum output. So what you're doing is taking a computer program and mimicking the evolutionary process, if that makes sense to you. So that's one example of how computers can mimic or can use biology as a metaphor. Oh, wait a minute, I'm going... Okay. Another example is called neural networks, which have been around for, you know, a good 30, 40 years, I guess. Neural networks are a computer algorithm that can actually learn from its surroundings. Again, you wouldn't use this to add 2 and 2. You wouldn't use it to send an email. But what they are computer programs that mimic the brain. And they do that by learning. They're trainable. They're teachable. They can learn by making improvements in their structures when they are primed by an optimum solution, if that makes sense to you. For example, when you go to the store and you charge something and they ask you to write your signature on a little computer screen, well, have you ever thought, you know, how does this program recognize your signature? You know, how does it do that? Well, sometimes it uses a neural network. And it uses that neural network to train the computer program to recognize the way you would write an A, recognize the way you would write a B. I don't know if I'm making this very comprehensible, but if you kind of know what the solution looks like, you would tell that to the computer program, and you would say, okay, I'm going to try and train you to take the solution and make it better and make it better and make it better, ultimately to teach it or train it to make the best solution that it can. In the same way that the brain learns by experience, these neural networks learn by, let's say, starting from an optimum solution and then working backwards. I don't know if I've explained that very well, but let's see. I'm going forwards. All right. Now, if I really want to stretch your imagination, picture trying to solve some difficult math problem by shaking up a chemical in a test tube. This has been done about 15 years ago. A computer genius named Len Edelman was thinking about biology, and he realized that he could take a strand of DNA, which is encoded with different proteins called nucleotides, and in the same way you could combine pieces of a jigsaw puzzle to fit together, you could take these strands of DNA with codes, you could combine them in a test tube, and they would combine in such a way that the certain codes would match up, right? So he said, well, you know, if I can run a computer program based on codes, why can't I combine DNA in a test tube with a certain code on each strand and make it match up and tell me something? So he actually did that in what's called a DNA computation. So he took individual strands of DNA and he combined them according to the way they were encoded, and then he would read them out, and they would reveal a solution. He tried to solve a very well-known mathematical problem called the traveling salesman problem. You have 7 cities, 1 salesman, and you're looking for the shortest route between cities. And he succeeded in finding the answer with his strands of DNA. This discovery made headlines in the New York Times, and it spawned a whole new avenue of research called DNA computing. So far, scientists have only been able to solve a limited number of problems with DNA, but the hope is that the applications will grow. The advantage you'll have with DNA computing is that it can perform billions of computations simultaneously, cut down on time and space limitations of traditional computers. The last kind of biologically inspired computer application I'll talk to you about is computer immune systems. As you can imagine, here we have a computer that tries to mimic an important property of biological organisms, their immune systems. Today we know that computers are increasingly prone to attacks from viruses and other types of cyber attacks like hackers. The field of information security and information assurance is one of the most is one of the most growing fields in IT. So the problem of how to protect our computers is very complex and very challenging. So biology has been able to suggest a better way. We know that there's no system, living or man-made, that can protect itself so effectively on so many levels and from so many different diseases and infections in the human immune system. It's evolved over many millions of years in the course of responding to pathogens to become a very sophisticated and effective system for protecting against disease. The human immune system functions on the basic operating principle that is able to distinguish self, i.e. the cells that are recognized as integral parts of the organism, from non-self, which are outside or foreign agents which could potentially cause us harm. So all the body's cells carry distinctive molecules that distinguish them as self, as part of self, while foreign bodies have another distinctive marker that enables the body to recognize them as non-self. The body can recognize over a million billion different types of foreign agents, and it responds to them, as you know, by producing antibodies to fight them off. Well, computer scientists have been driven to study this remarkable system and to find a digital analog for it, to find a method that could protect our computers as effectively as our bodies do. So what they essentially do is look for computer immune systems that are distributed, that are redundant, that can remember past attacks, that are multi-layered, and can replenish itself continuously. This would be important because, as we know, new viruses are generated every day, and they make commercial antivirus software is very easily outdated. So researchers have developed a system with these properties. They are based on an ability to distinguish known users of systems, self, from unknown users, or authorized programs from unauthorized programs. These systems can protect us against unwanted intruders, detect and eliminate them, and remember previous infections, and also protect against new ones. So I've tried to give you a flavor with these examples of how scientists have been trying to make our digital machines learn from nature. Whether it's actually using biological materials to compute or else mimicking a biological function, the trick is to understand how biological organisms process information, to hone in on the essential method of functioning or the logic behind it, and abstract these principles in such a way that they can be translated into the language of machines and incorporated into the machine itself. Do you think this trend will grow in the future? You bet it will. We know that not only will computer usage grow and they'll become more ubiquitous in our lives, but the machines themselves will become faster, cheaper, more powerful with more memory and have a larger span of control. Concomitant to this is another sweeping trend, which is the knowledge revolution in biology. We now understand so much about what constitutes life, its raw materials, the exquisitely complicated way of biological organisms organize themselves, and their even more complex way of functioning that has become a veritable knowledge explosion. What's more, we now have the capability to map many genomes and store all this information in very accessible computer databases. If you put these two trends together, it promises to yield a powerhouse of new ideas and innovation for making man-made digital computers more like natural organisms. At a recent World Economic Forum, the participants commented that they felt the technology created from the fusing of biology and computer science might be the most important to emerge in the future, possibly even dwarfing the Internet. I feel the promise of this field certainly justifies this prognostication. I'm going to give you a very short little epilogue to tell you about something even more far out that's you know, currently very important trend for the future that I believe will come to pass maybe in the next 10 to 15 years, which is quantum computing, which is even weirder. A quantum computer is composed of atomic particles, which are manipulated in such a way as to make them represent a one or a zero in binary logic. Because of the weird principles of the quantum principles of atoms, a property known as superposition means that a particle can be up or down or simultaneously up or down or in some mixture of up and down. This means that for a given number of particles in superposition, one can examine all the known solutions. It's notions like this of technological progress that I really feel can be dizzying to contemplate. So I'm going to end on this note. I'm about to hand the program over to George, who will talk to you about many other changes in the future, and we'll have time for Q&A afterwards. But I'd like to help stimulate a debate about the role of technology in our lives. And in that regard, I'd like to throw out the following. As much of a bona fide technophile as I am, I worry a lot about the impact of technology on our lives. I feel that our technological future, in only seen in the way that computers have affected our lives so far, may very well become so overpowering that it could really change the fabric of our lives. And in fact, I really believe it is doing that, judging from the way that text messaging is changing our language and our thought patterns. I really feel it's important that both that we as scientists and non-scientists, we understand that technology is a tool of man, it's not its master, and that we work very hard to not let it overcomplicate our lives or speed up our lives so much and kind of take over, although I realize this may be swimming against the tide. I'd like to end this with a cautionary note from a speech that Winston Churchill gave at MIT in 1949. They were celebrating the 50th year of MIT's existence, and he gave a very fascinating speech at MIT, and where he was admonishing the public to, yes, technology is all wonderful, and we won the war with technology and radar and airplanes, and you know, but be mindful that technology is no, you know, not the end-all, be-all, and it's no solution in themselves. I think this is a wonderful quote. He says, with the technological advances in the first half of the 20th century, the whole prospect and outlook of mankind grew immeasurably larger, and the multiplication of ideas also proceeded at an incredible rate. This vast expansion was unhappily not accompanied by any noticeable advance in the stature of man, either in his mental faculties or in his moral character. His brain got no bigger, but it buzzed more. The scale of events around him assumed gigantic proportions, while he remained about the same size. So, sounding like a Luddite, I'm going to give the podium over to George.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm delighted to be here with you. After 30 years on campus and four of my own kids graduated, I love coming back to college campus every time I get a chance to. Little knowledge is a dangerous thing, though, right? Like the happy dog in the car backing out of the driveway saying to the unhappy dog in the Far Side cartoon, "Ha ha ha, I get to go to the vets and be tutored." Let me also say I'm envious of you folks. I would give a lot to be around in 2050 to see what's going on. I'll try to say a little bit about what might be going on in 2050. And man, it's going to be interesting. And I would love to be there with you. Good luck to me. I'll be 110 at the time. But you never know. I'll say it a little. I look forward by looking back. I had supper with one of your historian members, and we shared some interesting discussions on the history. I'll have a few slides, and I wanted you to know I personalized it to talk for students by saying this is students over time rather than general people over time. And then IT, the applications that I see, and then a few caveats to end up with and see what you have to think about this. This Tower of Fives, I actually created myself and then found that Ray Kurzweil, a much more noted author than I, also did it. Well, I see that the it's supposed to be a perfect thing, but you should always check over your slides when you move them down to a different machine. What can you do? Pretend like it's a Berkeley thing. Look at that. That's 5 billion years ago the Earth was formed. 500 million years ago, that is 9/10 of the time, had passed before multicellular life formed. 9/10 additional passed before the rise of the mammals. Again, 9/10, 5 million for our humanoid forms that separated from the other chimpanzees. And then by 500,000 years, we had larger brains and were starting to make fires and who knows what all we were doing. And by 50,000 years ago, we were Homo sapiens, undoubtedly we're speaking. And maybe, as I've heard, if you take a baby out of a cave in 50,000 years ago and put him in your own crib, you wouldn't tell the difference. 5,000 years ago, we created civilization. That's after 5,000 years of agriculture, which gave us a sedentary base to sit down and start thinking about things and create language and mathematics and city-states and priests and religion and all sorts of things. And then only 500 years ago, our Western civilization arose, which gave us, among many other things, digital computers, only on the order of 50 years ago. Western Civ, I think, has a lot of information technologies. The two pre-information, and maybe even the compass you think of as an information technology, since it gives you the information of which direction is which. In the old days, they used to say gunpowder, the compass, and the printing press were the three major inventions of Western civilization. Well, probably the three major early inventions of Western civilization. Compass led to global sailing, and Columbus, and Magellan, and Vasco da Gama, and all those folks. So West was getting off to a pretty interesting start 500 years ago. From my worm's eye view of the world, of course, the world changed fundamentally about 400 years ago when science was created. Right? If you think about the pre-science world mentality versus the post-science world mentality, it's hugely different. Hugely different. And sometimes underplayed, except in business circles, is the fact that the commercial society, so-called, what now today we call capitalism, really got its start first in the Low Countries and then in England. So that by 1776, when Adam Smith wrote Wealth of Nations, he had 100 years of capitalism under his belt to write and tell us all about the invisible hand and how it would prevent subprime mortgage fiascos and other things like that. Right? So we know all about economics today. But of course, Smith was talking about cottage capitalism with human power and wind power and a little bit of water power. The really amazing thing happened, I think, 200 years ago with the beginnings of the Industrial Revolution. Probably the archetypical invention I think about is the steam engine, invented earlier in the 1700s by Newcomen and then improved by Watt to the point that it ended up powering factories, powering steamships, powering railroads. And many historians that I have read have agreed that there have been more changes in the last 200 years than in the previous 5,000 years. Well, if that's true, that's a pretty amazing thing, right? And that says we're existing in a time of unprecedented change. Is there any wonder that the economists or any of the rest of us don't know what's going on? 200 years is too short a time for the dim-witted human species to figure out which end is up. We're just barely getting started, and worse, the changes are coming even faster. Right? I would describe since 1800 as the age of automation, the first half of which was the age of automating muscles via steam, the second half of which now is automating mind power versus things like computers and internets and ultimately biological inspired computing and things like that. So we're in the second half of the age of automation, and probably you ain't seen nothing yet. Look, let's look over, I guess I can't say, think about the students at UVA in 1800. We'll have to say William and Mary, right? UVA didn't show up till another decade or two later. But think of the folks at William and Mary in 1800, and think of the mindset that they must have had. It was total an agricultural age. 90% of the workforce worked on the family farm. So everybody did agriculture. How did they get around? They got around with horses. If they had any help, it was with the horses, with windmills, with water wheels, and that type of thing. Oh, and by the way, your average age of deceasement was 40. Right? You'd be probably in the grave at the age 40. You certainly had what you would call a local life. If you talked with anybody, it was via the postal service. So you're talking about days, weeks, months, if it's overseas, to get any information anywhere. That's pretty far away from our experience, isn't it? Well, how about 100 years later? Approximately 100 years ago. Now we can talk about UVA students, I guess. Although maybe they were doing the same thing at William and Mary, too. It was the industrial age. I still had horses for local transportation and local farm work and that type of thing, but maybe only half the people were on the farm now in the United States. And the iron horse, the steam engine, the steam trains, had revolutionized the nation just like steamships had revolutionized global travels. But you know, we had states before 1900. We had a nation after 1900. They tell you it was the Civil War that made a nation out of us. No, it was the railroad and the telegraph, which got rid of regionalism and gave us nationalism because we had the communication resources and the transportation resources to do things on a national basis. And by the way, great increase in life expectancy. You could expect to live to 47 at that time. So how about you and me? Well, we certainly call this the post-industrial age or the information age, as some people say. Cars have certainly replaced the horses, except my sister and brother-in-law who farm in Illinois and have a horse boarding service have told me that there are more horses today for recreational purposes than there were horses for laboring purposes 100 years ago. That blew me away. Well, planes have replaced trains. What a difference, right? I went to Japan for my son's wedding in May. 12 hours from D.C. to Tokyo. 12 hours. What would Magellan have thought about that? And, of course, I guess if we've lived this long, if I've lived this long, I can expect to live past 77. And I guess, you know, that's still pretty good compared to 47. We certainly have the global life. We have our TV. We have our cell phones. We have our PCs. We have our internet. That's our world, isn't it? We are embedded in a technological world. And at least at NSF, if the computer network goes down, people call in and say, well, can I go home? There's nothing else to do. So we think about if the power goes off or the car stops or the network goes down. Just forget it. Nothing we can do. So let me now say just one slide, not too technical, about my view of the technology. I was a young professor in 1970, and I guess I first helped sell this machine to Iowa State, and then as I went on the staff, I helped install it and make it work. Pre-chip technology, discrete components. Well, they were transistors. They weren't vacuum tubes by that time. It was actually several million dollars, not just one, and that's 1970 dollars, probably more like $10 million by today's monies. And that machine, if you really pushed it, could do 1 million instructions per second. Well, that's a phantasmagorical number, so it sounds big. But this little guy sitting right here can do 1 billion instructions per second. So this tiny machine, which costs $1,000, is 1,000 times faster than the room full of a machine we had in 1970. That's a price performance increase of a factor of 1,000,000 in 30 years. Well, you've probably heard things about, well, how fast would planes go if we had a price performance increase of 1,000,000? When in fact, it's 10, right? We go from a train to a plane, we go from 50 miles an hour to 500 miles an hour. Even the horse did 5, so two orders of magnitude, 100 times faster is all we've done for transportation. We're doing thousands and millions of times in information technology. That's just barely starting to change the world. It's this next 50 years where that's going to make changes that will make your life very different. So compare 2000 to 1970, chip versus free chip, $1,000,000 versus $1,000. The speeds, as I just mentioned, a million instructions per second versus 1,000 or a giga number of instructions per second. Disks, you know, the little hard disks that you have in your machine? You know, when hard disks were first created in 1955, it cost $1 a byte, $1 a character to store the disks. Is it any wonder that we economized and only put 2 digits a year in the fields, even though it got us into terrible trouble with the millennium problem in 2000 because we still had the old software working that we thought we would have gotten rid of? We couldn't afford it. That's $2 more per character every time you store it. Well, by now, we're now less than $1 a gigabyte. 1,000,000,000 characters cost $1 as opposed to a single one. There's a factor of improvement of 1,000,000,000 in storing information. How about the networks? Well, we installed our first cross-state computer network in 1970, and we didn't have 10,000 bits per second. We had 5,000 bits per second and paid an arm and a leg for it. Well, now, I'm sure you guys are members of Internet too, which means you have a 10 gigabit line coming into campus. And you probably have gigabit Ethernet and are looking at 10 gigabit Ethernet on the local campus as well. Those are pretty big numbers. By the way, a 10 gigabit line is what we need to have full time from the Large Hadron Collider, the physics device which is opening up in CERN even as we speak. It's going to produce and save a petabyte a month. Now, that's a lot of zeros after a petabyte, believe me. Believe me. Gigabyte, terabyte, petabyte. So 1,000,000 gigabytes per month produced by that machine, which they want to transfer every place around the world and put on every physics workstation to work on a little piece of figuring out whether there was any interesting event. Well, if you have a well-functioning 10 gigabit line, you can transfer a petabyte a month. So we just barely made it to the point where we can take care of those greedy physicists. Do you suppose we can do any better than this? I'm a little afraid to push this and see what type of reformatting may have happened. All right. We will have post-chip technologies in 30 years. Nancy's told you some about that. Biological-inspired computing, quantum-inspired computing, probably maybe all optical computing. Replace moving electrons around with moving photons around. They go pretty fast if we only could figure out how to have optical memory and stop them every now and then. But also, we keep saying Moore's Law is going to peter out and we aren't going to be able to make our circuit smaller and smaller. And then they say, well, we found a way to extend it for another 5 years. Well, another 5 years. So who knows how small the chips are going to be and how multifunction they're going to be by then. All these things, I think we can do a linear extrapolation. So I think the computer that today costs $1,000 and gives you 1,000,000,000 instructions per second, 30 years from now, will cost $1 and give you 1,000,000,000,000 instructions per second. That sounds like I'm a fool, right? Well, let me tell you, if I had stood up in 1970 and said, you're going to have a $1,000 computer that will do 1,000,000,000 instructions per second in 2000, I would have been just as big a fool. Just as big a fool. In fact, my old mentor at Iowa State used to say, don't tell them what you think or they will think you're a fool. You've got to cut it way down in size for the public because it sounds too phantasmagorical. At the bottom there I say that the networks might even be 10 petabits per second. That's a lot. That's a lot. And it's... I think I've said enough about the technology, except to tell you that I think the thing that is most amazing and most useful to us in this is the decrease in price, not the increase in performance. Okay? Would we all have computers if they cost $1 million? Oh, you'd be using some overworked mainframe and trying to access it and so on and so forth. The fact that that thing costs $1,000 and this thing costs $500 and wherever I put my Kindle, it costs $400. We're getting down, and these will all be dirt cheap as time goes along, and we can expect everybody to have multiple devices. Moreover, of course, we can expect everything we own to be computerized. But we already have 10 or 20 computers in the average car and a couple in the average washing machine. And these are all going to be wirelessly networked to the global internet. We're going to need those petabits per second. We will live in such an intensely technological world that it's important to think what's happening to us from a human standpoint. Let's go over a list of applications from the happening now to the maybe will be happening in 50 years. Simulation and modeling. Talking with one of your esteemed faculty members beforehand, who is an example of someone who's doing multi-agent modeling of simulation, and some of the very interesting examples that are going to come out of that, simulating a village, I think we heard, where each computer agent represents a person, and you can do things like tracking AIDS activity. You can work it into the water. Circumstances, social modeling as well as lower level biological modeling as well as simple things like the atmosphere or galaxy formation. We're pretty good at that right now. When you bring people into this situation, it gets a lot more complicated. I've already mentioned sensors and actuators. Your refrigerator will order milk when you run out automatically from the grocery store, trivial things like that. Department of Defense will see that every bullet has a IP version 6 address, and collaboration, social computing. Do you guys do Facebook and that type of stuff, and texting rather? My kids won't email with me anymore. They say that's passé, Dad. We text. We don't do email. And the collaboration, the degree of collaboration we're able to do with IT-enhanced collaboration, I think is spawning the new dimension of the field that's now called knowledge management, studied in social sciences and business colleges and the like. I lead the NSF's knowledge management activity, and I can see that that will get us out of our hierarchies into much more collaborative work environments over the next decade. Information and knowledge... I think that, intellectually speaking, I think that the development of the web and the things that follow the web right now have the same feeling that 20 years ago the internet had for me. That is, the development of information resources now is at the same stage of development that the internet was 20 years ago. Perhaps you've heard of things like the semantic web. Well, this is a bunch of protocols that you can put on into the software mix that tell you the format to add metadata to the articles that you find on the web, which are so self-explanatory, if it works the way we want to, that a computer can read the thing. And this is happening in some areas where they have money to spend. Big Pharma, for example, has spent more than $1 billion annotating chemical research articles with semantic web metadata, and then they set computers to reading those articles, speaking loosely, of course, and if the computer finds a chemical that looks like a good candidate to turn into a drug, then they tap a human colleague on the shoulder and say, hey, look at this one a little bit further. So computers will become collaborators in science and eventually in other things as we learn how to properly annotate our information. Right now, the information on the web is for human consumption. It will be for computer consumption. That's the only way we will handle the information glut. We already get a million hits, right, per web search. Brain science and engineering is, I think, that one of the most interesting things is I read the popular books on brain science and what's happening in terms of how we are understanding the flow of information in the brain. I understand that the MRIs presently have about a 1 millimeter resolution. And that's halfway toward what we need to really understand brain functioning at the neuron level. And when we get there, we will have the computer capacity to manage that terrible amount of data and complexity. And Ray Kurzweil, one of the futurists that I read, predicts that the year is 2028 when we will have reverse engineered the brain and been able to sync what's happening in a computer into a computer. We always find out that things are more complicated than we thought they were at the time. So let's say it's 2040, not 2028. That's pretty soon, too. That's the half century that I'm talking about. Kurzweil thinks that by 2048, we will have networked all these brainy computers together, and humans can go back to gathering berries and fishing. Let's not even say we sink it in the silicon. Let's say that we finally figure out how humans learn. Gerald Edelman, a biologist who did some of that immune system stuff that Nancy was talking about, has recently been working on the brain. Some people think he's wacky. I think he's pretty interesting. He's looking for brain-based epistemology, figuring out in scientific, at the physiological terms, how the brain works. Well, if and when we get that, we will know how to scientifically apply computers to aiding the learning process. Right now, we give you stuff, do your homework on the computer, write your papers on the computer. That may be trivial compared to how computers will aid the learning process in the future. It's not good news for professors. When this happens, we will probably do a better job of educating people with student-teacher ratios of 200-to-1 than we do currently with 20-to-1. We will take the labor out of education just as we took the labor out of farming in the 19th and the 20th century. AIA, well, that's a cute phrase. IA stands for intelligence augmentation. By the time we get these computers working, just merely if they're helping us in education, if they are prosthetics for us in many sorts of ways, we will be augmenting human intelligence to a remarkable degree. And of course, the AI is the traditional computer science term of artificial intelligence. The guys in the labs have been working on that since the 50s at Dartmouth, for example, where we're working on things like natural language understanding, robotics, and all sorts of other interesting examples. Many of these things, if not being completed, will be carried to a great degree in the next 50 years. So what's that going to do? Let's talk about your grandchildren will be starting school in 2050, something like that. Are they going to be living in the post-work age? Well, Hans Maravec, who used to run the robotics lab at Carnegie Mellon, said that by 2050, all work will be automated, be none left at all. Sounds a little exaggerated to me. Let's say he's only half right. Let's say half the jobs are automated. What are we going to do with the other 50% of the people? Let them smoke dope? How are you going to handle a 50% unemployment rate? Auto cars. By that I mean, you know, we've got autopilots already in airplanes. Surely in 50 years, cars will drive themselves. And when they do, we'll probably go from 50,000 deaths in the U.S. to 500 deaths in the U.S. because the cars will be better than we are. And people at that time will say, my God, how did those people survive in 2000 with the carnage on the highways, killing off 50,000 of their fellow citizens every year? You know, you have a 3% chance, every one of us, in dying in an auto accident over the course of our life. Well, Kurzweil and others would think that by 2050 we'll have a life expectancy of 115. Well, maybe there's some luck for me. I'll only be 110, so maybe I'll make it. Virtual life? Well, augmented reality, designer life, now merging in the biology with the information technology. A guy who headed NASA way back in the 80s said, well, it's about time for carbon-based life to step aside and let its progeny, silicon-based life, take over. Yeah, sounds like science fiction to me. You guys, we've left you a few things to do. Why don't you take care of globalization issues, the pollution issues, the population issues, the rate of change that we're humans are trying to struggle with? Oh, and don't forget the age-old thing way down in our genes, tribalism. How are we going to get rid of tribalism in a global world? Let me close with a couple of remarks from a nice little book called Education's End, Why Our Colleges and Universities Have Given Up on the Meaning of Life. It was written by a Yale law professor who teaches in the Yale Directed Studies Program for diligent undergraduates. It, first of all, has the part that says, well, you know, all our students today think that life is a career. Well, he's trying to say life's more than a career. But then he goes on to, even more deeply rooted than the dogma of career, is our addiction to technology and the equation of truth with science. We live today in a narcotized stupor, blind to the ways in which our own immense powers and the knowledge that has produced them cuts us off from the knowledge of who we are. Nothing has a tighter hold on us today than technology and science. They fix our values, define the limits of our imagination, they cover the human condition in forgetfulness. Secular humanism is a force for recollection. This is a guy who's opining the demise of humanities as pursuing the meaning of life in colleges. And to conclude, he says, our world would have us forget that we are dying animals, fastened to bodies and fated to pass away, yet who yearn for something more. Our world has reduced death to an inconvenience, and thereby robbed us of our humanity. The technology that can cancel death is the great orthodoxy of our age. It is the piety by which we live. Secular humanism recalls us to the mortal facts. It helps us remember who we are. I think that's probably our challenge. How do we go forward? We're there. We're not going to turn back to 1800. We're not going to go back to an agriculture, non-technological world. We're there. How are you going to keep your humanism, keep your humanity, as you face an ever-increasing technological world? That's your question.
Probationaries, now we're going to move into the question and answer session, and while we do that, I'm going to pass out an attendance sheet, which I clumsily ripped, but please sign your name and make sure it's on here so you get credit for attending this program. So without further ado, the question and answer session, if you all would like to just come up here. All right.
I don't know, I saw these guys take after the probationary folks pretty good style earlier. Now we get to stand it. Let's shut this down.
Let's shut it down.
Yes, sir.
This is for Ms. Norbert.
Yes.
Thank you for coming and giving your speech, by the way. But you said that computers can recognize and immunize against viruses, but those viruses would be created by people. And surely the computer can't predict what a person is going to do. So wouldn't it be a trial by error and they would be getting viruses and humans could still kind of infect the systems because they don't know what the human's going to do?
But in the same way that the body uses the basic principle of recognizing the tissues that are the you know things that are inherent to the body, and they from a molecular standpoint they label those as self, and anything that comes from outside of the body is non-self, and so they recognize it and they attack it. The way these computer immune systems are set up, either they will work on the basis of known users of the system and an unknown user of the system. So it doesn't have to matter. It doesn't really matter what the characteristics of the unknown user is, as long as he's not a group of the he's not a group of the known computer users. So it's a self non-self kind of thing. And the same another way to set it up would be you would have known programs in the system. And if someone tried to come in and insert a virus or something that was not recognized, the system would just go, I don't recognize this. And they're trying to set it up in such a way that it's distributed throughout the system, that it's redundant, that it has a memory so we can recognize past attacks and so on. So it's the same way that the body does it, really. I don't know if that answers your question. Okay. Yes.
Ms. Ford,
thank you for
speaking. Oh, sure. So you mentioned before about, or I think you talked about, this idea of texting and how this might present a threat to society, just changing the way we communicate. But as we mentioned in dinner, as you quoted, there was some, who was it, put about the written language? Talk about how written language is a threat to memorization.
Therefore, a threat to learning. Because learning equals memorization.
What is a real threat when it comes to the change in communication?
I think that might be putting it a little too strongly. I didn't feel it was a threat to society, but if you look at the way our thought processes developed and the way, this is my own very personal feeling, is that one comes to college and you really learn how to think critically about something. You learn how to construct an argument. You learn how to reason in a sustained way, you learn how to develop a coherent body of thought. But if from the time you're 12 years old, you're not reading a sustained, text for a 20 minute, 30 minute, 40 period of time, you're just getting things in fragments, you're constructing sentences in fragments. Over time, it does affect the way your thoughts are patterned. And for example, in Japan, there's a whole new literary genre called text message novels. If you compare a text message novel with William Faulkner or Flaubert, to me, there's absolutely no comparison. So I see it in my own language, and I'm someone, because I was a literature major, I really prize language. It's one of the aesthetic pleasures of being human, is to have a wonderful sense of language and the riches. Look at James Joyce. And in my own emails, I become short, I become, I lose that sense. You look at Jefferson's letters, they're subtle, they're rich, they're thoughtful. You write an email, you lose all of that. Over time, if that's the way our minds are going to continue to function because we don't write letters anymore, how will that affect our thought processes? That, I'm just posing the question. I don't know, I wouldn't say it's a threat, but it could be. I think that's something that we should all think about over time. Will we become so fragmentary and so fashioned, so fashioned around the soundbite and the bit here, the fragment here, and so on, that we cease to get a sense of a coherent whole? I think that could be damaging, personally. But I don't know if you agree with me or not. I think the whole idea of a society is to create, a system of thought where people can create and sustain an argument and debate it and so on, right? Which is a skill that's been going on for many, many, hundreds of years.
Everyone agrees that probably is changing things, and I'm holding my vote to see whether it's for the better or the worse or just different.
Well, we'd like to move
this. Yes.
Yes. into the body's immune system, and the body is the image she corresponds to differentially between the self antigens and foreign antigens.
Are you a biology major?
No, I'm not.
Oh, well, it sounds like you are. That's great. I mean, I think it's wonderful. Yes, exactly.
And I was wondering if there's equivalent, if that's the virus is, whether computers are better equipped to handle, like autoimmune disorder,
based on what I know about computer immune systems, it's still very experimental. There's a couple of companies that have put out a version of a computer immune system that is fairly rudimentary in the sense that it recognizes a virus as being something that comes from outside the computer system and so on. But I don't think the technology has reached the point where it can mimic, the way an autoimmune disease functions and so on. I mean, nature is so complicated. We've only, reached that first stage where we get to say this is self and this is non-self. So, I mean,
we're working on finding it. Certainly,
exactly,
today's technology,
exactly,
which I spent half my life doing security and privacy, the only way we get on top of viruses is find what the crooks have done and then look for that specific virus. So we look for tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands that show up. And right now, foreign stuff coming in. You know what a bot is and a botnet? Heard that phrase? Botnet, a bot is a little foreign thing that comes into your computer, and they're pretty good now, and they can hide even from programs that look to see if there's any foreign computers on your machine, or foreign software on your machine. They will do such things as capture every keystroke you put in, and send it up to via the botnet to the host sometime to see if you put in your account numbers and passwords and all sorts of things. Also, use your machine to send spam to other places, and they can't tell where it really came from. And even most interesting, perhaps, at least at the moment, use your machine as part of a distributed denial of service attack. There's a lot of this going on. Right? This is organized crime, not kitty people doing things. A company that lives on the internet gets a call from an extortionist saying, tomorrow your machine will have 10 million hits and go down at 10 o'clock unless you pay me to prevent it from happening. And so there's a lot of that going on that the company doesn't want to make any publicity about. So, and it's estimated that 10 million machines in the United States are part of botnets. We went around the room, that's probably 1 out of 10 of us having that on our computers. So it's an unsolved problem, and we're looking for biological inspiration. Why can't we do as good a job as other nature?
Mm-hmm.
Thanks,
Kevin.
Two
more questions.
You talked a lot about the expansion of the hardware and the software aspect of computers. It's really pretty mind-blowing. And theoretically, we have the capability transfer all this information, share all this information, and the technology has also been democratized to the extent that really access has improved tremendously. Yet the human aspect of things seems almost to be the problem. We, as you were talking about, we also have people becoming disconnected from reality, people focusing in on the little patches of information rather than on the sustained information which would be possible for computers. And I'm wondering, if either of you have any insights of why there is that disconnect between the capability of the machine and what we're actually using it for, which is to almost divorce ourselves from the connectivity aspect of it.
Well, don't forget, we're a 50,000-year-old species. We were designed to live in groups of 100 people, isolated from everybody else, to hunt and gather and do that type of thing. We have used our immensely interesting brains to create situations that our biology isn't ready for. But it doesn't surprise me again that we've outgrown our technology. And now the question is, can our technology help us advance, pick ourselves up by our biological bootstraps, or will we continue to have nationalism and tribalism and fundamentalism and all sorts of isms that will You know, let's hope the 21st century is better than the 20th. 100 million people killed in wars and related affairs in the 20th century, more than all previous centuries put together. Well, not that they didn't try hard in the previous centuries. They didn't have the technology to get the job done. We've got even better technology than we did. We could probably do 1 billion people in this century without trying too hard. So the human element is the hard part of the equation.
I think in a good sense, the way that email has created a truly connected society, a truly connected world, I mean, I think it's wonderful the way that technology can help connect us. You know, it's a double-edged sword. I mean, in many respects, we rely so much on email that we don't really see people anymore. We don't sit down and have a long conversation, or, you know, there are many ways in which it isolates us. So, I think the human problems will continue to remain the same, and I think technology will either exacerbate them or it won't. And it's, you know, that's why I feel technology is a tool, and you can't let it become the master.
See, I'll bet people 100 years ago said the same thing about the telephone.
I'm sure.
Oh, we don't have face-to-face conversations anymore. We pick up the phone and call somebody. Well, that's true. And now you can call your mother across the country. You're not going to have a face-to-face with your mother every day if she lives across the country. So I think their argument can be made that technology is bringing us closer together, not driving us further apart. Just after we have to understand it's in a modified fashion. The other night, my youngest son, who's teaching, doing Teach for America in the Chicago inner city, and is desperately homesick, we did his two sisters in Oregon and Cincinnati, and his brother and new wife, and my wife and I in Virginia, all got on a Macintosh group telephone experience. And we just jabbered. In fact, everybody jabbered at once. But you could sort of see it relieved some of his homesickness. We were able to get together across 3,000 miles by the intermediating technology. I think it's got a good side as well as a dangerous side.
Yes.
Once again, thank you very much for coming. So I am sort of a science fiction fan, and
you heard some tonight, didn't you?
Yeah. But I'm wondering as well. With the example of the telephone, we're not getting a telephone an immune system, and we're not making it more human-like. Yes. So when I hear that we're, or is there concern in your circles that giving silicon-based life forms, I guess, carbon-based ideas? Is that scary to some people? Is that a concern that eventually silicon-based life could replace carbon-based life because we're giving it human entities? And if so, where do you draw the line of humanity? When do they become autonomous?
And you can send that argument to designer babies, and this is a very big controversy. I think Francis Fukuyama wrote a very interesting book about it, Our Biological Future or something. I agree. I mean, in China they don't worry a whole lot about bioethics. Here we do, and which I think is a great thing. I think these are really relevant.
It's bioethics now that people worry about, but infoethics hasn't hit the market yet.
I think these things are going to be really crucial, and I think it take bioethicists to kind of figure out the answers.
Maybe. Okay. Please, no. One more.
Okay. And then we'll stand up afterwards.
Yes. You choose. Okay.
Are there any aspects of this technological progression that frighten you, either of you?
Sure. There's going to be so many unexpected consequences. When the neutron was discovered in 1930, I don't think people thought, "Ooh, good, now we can blow up the world with an atomic bomb." A wonderful scientific discovery in terms of knowledge. What are we going to do here? Well, all right, let's say we do reverse engineer the brain. How is that going to be used? For humanity, for better advertising to convince us that we really want that bigger car? Probably.
as we defend ourselves more from more knowledgeable modern-day adversaries. It goes without saying that terrorism and industrial warfare and international warfare is going to have a very much of a cyber dimension to it. What if they take down air traffic control and every plane in the sky is without any communication with the ground? What if the power grid goes down? Again, we are so dependent on anybody who thinks that we're not dependent on our technology. I hope we don't have a chance to find out how dependent we are. And if you don't have a certain amount of fear at the same time and go forward, it's just because you don't understand the situation.
The only thing I would say was that, you know, technology has caused an incredible increase in the rate of social change. I mean, my mother's 86, and she gets baffled by things, the way they change so quickly. And, you know, I'm a different generation than you, but sometimes I think things are too fast. And I think if I get on a plane and I go from here to, you know, to Tokyo in 12 hours, that, you know, that kind of shouldn't be, right? I mean, it's a different part of the world, and you know, it almost doesn't sink in, kind of. So
basically, in 2 hours.
Exactly. So you know, I mean, it's quite true if you think about it. If you go to places in the developing world, the rhythm of life is much slower, and I think technological change has caused a parallel increase in the rate of change. And that worries me a little bit, too, because I think that could have some bad consequences.
Read another book called Doing Nothing, History of the Work Ethic in the Age of Automation.
Sorry, it's not really good at all. Can you thank Mr. Stein?